This episode features discussions of kidnapping and graphic violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
It was the morning of December 12, 1936, on a mountaintop outside the small city of Xi'an. The most powerful man in China, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, stood weakly in the mouth of a cave, utterly spent. He knew he was going to die.
Earlier that day, his headquarters had been stormed by armed men. Terrified for his life, he'd fled out a window, leaving behind his shoes, dressing gown, even his false teeth. Now his guards lay dead in the valley below. The cold winter morning had worn him down. He was freezing and exhausted.
He knew he had two choices: die shivering and alone, or give himself up to a military execution. His pride would only allow one thing. The Generalissimo left the cave and approached the rebel soldiers.
Within minutes, Chiang was surrounded by armed guards. Their leader was the baby-faced Sun Ming-chu.
Chiang Kai-shek raised his voice above the howling winter wind. "If you are my comrades, shoot me and finish it all." But Ming-chu only shook his head. He replied, "We will not shoot. We only ask you to lead our country."
This is Hostage on the Parcast Network. I'm Carter Roy. Every Thursday, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
And I'm Irma Blanco. We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations and what the human brain does when held captive.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
This is our second episode on the kidnapping of Chinese nationalist leader Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, an event that is also known as the Xi'an Incident.
In 1936, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, chairman of the Kuomintang, or Nationalist Party, had full control over the military, but he was growing steadily more unpopular for refusing to push back against the Japanese invasion of Manchuria to the north.
Instead, he had focused his energy on trying to eradicate the Communist Party from China, a task that was proving expensive and difficult, as communist guerrilla fighters were hidden throughout the Chinese countryside and proved nearly impossible to track down.
Last week, we introduced Yang Hucheng and Zhang Shuliang, two of the Generalissimo's most trusted generals who controlled a large part of the Nationalist Army.
By 1936, Zhang and Yang had grown frustrated wasting manpower and resources fighting the communists while doing nothing to stop the Japanese invasion. They came up with a plot to take the Generalissimo prisoner in order to force him to lead the fight against the Japanese.
This week, we'll delve into the 14 days that Chiang Kai-shek spent in captivity, which would ultimately give rise to a new communist China. On December 12, 1936, Chiang surrendered himself to rebel forces at the mouth of a cave just outside Xi'an. He was taken to a black Buick waiting at the bottom of the mountain. The Buick drove into the city.
The car pulled up to a group of boxy brick buildings in the center of the city. There, Chiang Kai-shek eyed a military band standing at attention to greet him.
He recognized the soldiers in the band as serving under General Yang Hucheng, a pragmatic former warlord whose interests lay mostly in survival.
Chiang Kai-shek and Yang Hucheng had shared a close relationship ever since Yang had joined the Nationalist military in 1930. Chiang Kai-shek had counted Yang as a loyal subordinate, but now he realized that Yang, too, had betrayed him. He truly had no one.
Yang's men brought Chiang Kai-shek into a richly appointed meeting room where the other conspirator, Zhang, was waiting for him on one of the white-covered sofas.
Seeing the young Marshal Zhang sitting there among the traitors was especially heart-wrenching for Chiang. He had known the wealthy and handsome young Marshal for nearly 10 years. They had met in 1926, shortly after Zhang's father had been killed in an assassination plot by Japanese occupiers.
Zhang had subsequently pledged himself and his armies to the nationalist government in hopes of taking revenge on the Japanese. He looked to Chiang Kai-shek as a sort of father figure, and by all accounts, they had an extremely close relationship. But that all felt tarnished now.
Zhang claimed he only wanted to talk with Chiang Kai-shek and had no knowledge of the kidnapping plot up until the night before the actual event.
But while it was true that the young marshal had only agreed to the plot the night before, he had known about Yang's intention to kidnap the generalissimo for weeks, and he'd been negotiating an alliance with the communists for even longer. Zhang had used a practice known as paltering in the hopes that it would get the generalissimo to trust him.
Paltering is to lie by using the truth. Though everything Zhang said was technically true, his statement was meant to be misleading. According to a 2016 study in the Harvard Business Review, paltering is a common tactic used in negotiations with inexperienced negotiators. It is almost always a bad idea.
Paltering allows the liar to maintain an image of themselves as honest and trustworthy, something that would have appealed to Zhang, who saw himself as a brave patriot.
But paltering has its drawbacks. If the strategy is discovered, the person on the receiving end will learn not to trust the palterer. As for Chiang Kai-shek, he quickly realized that the young marshal was being dishonest. Zhang had shot himself in the foot before the negotiations had even started.
Chiang clammed up, refusing to sit down with Zhang. Ever the drama queen, Chiang said, "My head may be cut off. My body may be mutilated, but if I allow the honor of the people to be degraded by accepting any demands in order to save my own life, we should lose our national existence."
To be clear, no one was threatening to cut off his head.
And although the generalissimo refused to speak with Zhang, the young marshal wasn't bothered. In fact, he was really only there to stall for time.
Zhang believed that it was only a matter of time until the nation at large would hear about the kidnapping. He hoped the ensuing tidal wave of popular support would force the generalissimo to take his side.
After their brief meeting, the generalissimo refused to engage any further with Zhang. He retreated to a small dark room furnished with a wooden bed, a bucket, and a broom. He pulled the dirty bedclothes over his head, turned to face the wall, and refused to speak to anyone.
This was a tactic Chiang used somewhat often. The historian Pishan Lo describes Chiang's tendency to withdraw behind a mental wall as a way of preserving a personality threatened with collapse. In simpler terms, he isolated himself when the reality of his mistakes had grown too terrible for him to bear.
During his captivity, Chiang Kai-shek would create a physical version of his mental wall by throwing a blanket over his head to form a literal barrier between himself and the people forcing him to confront his own misgivings.
On the first morning of his captivity, December 13, 1936, Chiang Kai-shek refused breakfast and tea. One of the officers keeping watch outside his room offered him a fur-lined cloak, which he also declined.
When someone suggested that he be moved to much more comfortable living quarters in a nearby building, Chiang replied that if he was not released, he would die where he was.
Lo characterized Chiang as a crisis personality. As the poor child of a cold and distant single mother, he often felt neglected and abandoned in his youth. To cope, he would frequently expose himself to dangerous situations as a way of manufacturing the attention he so desperately craved. In captivity, Chiang found himself once again resorting to extremes in order to have an effect on his captors.
Zhang came to see him four times that first day, and each time Chiang refused to speak. Eventually, Sun Ming Chu was sent in with a pistol and ordered the general to move. But Chiang wouldn't budge. Sun stayed there for an hour and a half before giving up.
The kidnappers were left with little to do but wait and hope that their stunt would garner the attention they so deeply needed to succeed.
Meanwhile, as Chang was arriving at Marshal Zhang's headquarters in Xi'an, news of his kidnapping was reaching the Kuomintang in Nanking.
In the immediate aftermath of the kidnapping, Zhang had sent telegrams to political leaders all over China. The telegrams first guaranteed the safety of Chang, then laid out their demands in 8 points.
The first point was the reorganization of the Kuomintang. Yang and Zhang wanted all parties, including the communists, to have a voice in the Chinese government.
Their second point was a ceasefire between the communists and nationalists. They called for an alliance and an armed resistance against Japan.
The next 4 points related to Chiang Kai-shek's suppression of free speech and political dissent. In the months leading up to the Xi'an incident, resistance to the Japanese occupation had been spreading across China. Each act of protest or dissent was met with government retribution. In addition, the Kuomintang had shut down 14 popular magazines, violently broken up protests, and arrested 7 prominent civilian leaders of the resistance movement. Zhang sought an end to this violation of human rights.
Point 7 was to put into effect the will of Dr. Sun Yat-sen, the deceased leader of the 1911 revolution and, arguably, the founder of the Nationalist Party.
This point gets a little tricky. Sun had been a charismatic leader, but his philosophies on governance tended to be vague and open to interpretation. For this reason, both Chiang Kai-shek and the Communist Party believed themselves to be honoring Sun's legacy and championing his principles.
Well, suffice to say, we'll gloss over this point as quickly as the majority of Chinese leadership did in 1936.
Finally, point number 8. They demanded a political summit to address a strategy for ending the Japanese occupation.
Yang and the young marshal had intended for their 8 points to incite an avalanche of popular support among the political leaders and people of China.
So naturally, they were surprised to discover that nobody had rallied behind them. Quite the opposite, in fact. The Kuomintang wanted to punish the mutineers by bombing Xi'an. They vigorously suppressed any news outlet attempting to publish the 8 points.
Meanwhile, because nobody knew what exactly was going on, rumors about Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek's kidnapping ran rampant across China. In Shanghai, there were stories of communist soldiers overtaking Xi'an, abducting young children, communizing, abusing the women, and setting the city on fire. The most pervasive rumor was that the Generalissimo was already dead.
According to Dr. Frank Ochberg, a pioneer in trauma science, misinformation can be severely damaging to the negotiation process. He says, quote, "A public which overreacts in outrage against the victim's helplessness may precipitate harsh, simplistic counter-terrorist measures."
The idea is that if people believe things are too far gone and the situation cannot be peacefully resolved, they have no qualms about taking drastic measures. In this case, the public who thought Chiang Kai-shek was already dead and the city was on fire would support bombing Xi'an instead of negotiating. Another strike against Zhang and the communist rebels.
The kidnappers were at a stalemate. Zhang began to worry that they had made a monumental mistake, especially as the truth about the kidnapping failed to spread like the wildfire he had been counting on. The rumors were more popular, and there wasn't widespread support. Nobody was entirely sure about what to do. The captors grew anxious, wondering if they would be bombed at any minute.
Then, a truly unique team of negotiators arrived in Xi'an and righted the course of the entire rebellion. In a moment, we'll meet the ragtag group of inexperienced negotiators who worked with the rebels to save Chiang's life.
And now, back to our story.
In December of 1936, one of the few people in China to get the full story about the kidnapping of the Generalissimo was a man named Zhou Enlai. Zhou was a communist renowned for his silver tongue, so much so that he would later go on to become the head of the propaganda unit for the Chinese Communist Party. Joe was also a former student of the Whampoa Academy that Generalissimo Chang had founded in 1924.
Joe and Lai had last encountered Chang in 1927. The Generalissimo had orchestrated a violent purge of communists across China. Joe had only survived the purge because Chiang Kai-shek had allowed him to escape. Rumor had it that Chang had done this in order to repay a similar debt stemming from an even earlier incident. Joe had managed to spare Chang from the wrath of an angry mob, and the two shared a mutual respect for one another. Perhaps this respect would save Chang's life once again.
On the morning of December 13, 1936, on the outskirts of an impoverished village in the remote Chinese countryside, Zhou Enlai and the leaders of the Communist Party received a telegram detailing Chang's abduction. Some greeted the news with gleeful laughter and demanded Chang's execution, but Zhou was eager to see the Generalissimo alive.
He set out for Xi'an immediately on the back of a donkey. Certainly, he was hoping to influence the outcome of events in favor of the communists, but more than that, he had personal relationships with those involved and a vested interest in seeing a peaceful resolution.
Just as Zhou Enlai was setting off for Xi'an, the Generalissimo's wife was in Shanghai receiving the news of her husband's capture and possible death.
Sung Chang Mei-ling was an aristocratic beauty, known as much for her charm and style as she was for her influential, powerful family. She was once described as possessing a terrifying amount of charm and poise. She was a force to be reckoned with.
The marriage was purely political. Though Chang already had two other wives at the time of his marriage to Mei-ling, he was quick to renounce both of them in order to ally himself with one of China's most powerful families.
Though he is rumored to have had copious affairs, Chang claimed he did not believe in sex for non-procreative reasons and maintained there was no reason for physical intimacy between Mei-ling and himself. Suffice to say, theirs was not a particularly romantic marriage. They worked better as business partners.
Mei-ling was in Shanghai when she got the news about her husband's kidnapping. She immediately turned to one of her closest and most trusted friends.
This friend held unparalleled influence among China's leaders and politicians. He was an extraordinary character of almost legendary status. Not since Marco Polo had a Westerner had such an influence on Chinese history. He was known simply as Donald of China.
William Henry Donald was a tall, broad-faced Australian journalist with a nose like a cherry tomato. He had no higher education, zero understanding of the Chinese language, and a self-professed detestation of Chinese food. But what he did have was a close relationship with every one of China's leaders throughout the 1930s.
At the time of Chang's kidnapping, he had been living with the Generalissimo and his wife at their bungalow and working under the catch-all title, advisor.
Donald was also close with Zhang Shuliang. He had once served as a personal secretary and mentor to him. In 1931, Donald had helped a then 30-year-old Zhang overcome his drug addiction. It was also Donald who convinced Zhang Shuliang to ally himself with the nationalists and pledge his troops to Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang.
Donald had an in with every person at the table. He was the perfect ally to handle negotiations. So he flew with Mei-ling from Shanghai to Nanking.
By the time Donald and Mei-ling landed in Nanking, preparations were well underway to bomb the entire city of Xi'an, certainly killing the Generalissimo alongside the communists.
Donald and Mei-ling were immediately ushered into a meeting with War Minister He Ying-chin and several of his advisors. Ying-chin was a longtime rival of Chang. They had attended the Japanese military academy together years before. Ying-chin was pressing for an attack on Xi'an, but Mei-ling had another idea. Instead, she should be sent to Xi'an to negotiate with Zhang and his conspirators. She was practically laughed out of the room.
But Mei-ling pled her case. She didn't believe that Zhang would have killed the Generalissimo. She'd known him longer than she'd known her own husband. They had met in 1925 at a party. Zhang had immediately fallen in love with her. She'd rejected his advances, but had always been fond of the young man and knew what a strong relationship he'd had with the Generalissimo.
Mei Ling also knew that Chang had plenty of enemies in Nanking who would be happy to replace him as chairman of the Kuomintang. An attack on Xi'an would be an easy way to dispatch with the unpopular Generalissimo.
Mei Ling quickly realized that she could not leave Nanking. It would be a full-time job keeping Chang's enemies from bombing Xi'an. She had to send someone else in her place, someone the war minister would go for. She quickly volunteered Donald for the job.
And Donald was quick to comply. He had already been in contact with the young Marshal Zhang, who had asked him to come to Xi'an to negotiate with the stubborn and uncompromising Chiang Kai-shek. The trip, it seemed, was fated.
The Kuomintang government had been hesitant to send China's first lady to Xi'an, but Donald was easier to agree to. He had the ear of powerful people across China, but possessed none of his own political clout. He was the perfect emissary.
Mei Ling and the war minister shook on it, and Donald was sent to pack for Xi'an.
Donald left for Xi'an laden with letters from Mei Ling and several pages from the Generalissimo's diary. The diary pages detailed an incident several years prior, when Chiang Kai-shek had met with delegates from the Communist Party to discuss a possible alliance against the Japanese. The negotiations hadn't gone anywhere, but Mei Ling thought they might prove to Zhang Shuliang that the Generalissimo really had intended to push the Japanese out of Manchuria. She hadn't lost hope that a compromise was possible.
Donald arrived in Xi'an on the second day of Chang's captivity, December 14th. He was greeted by Zhang's treasurer, who took him to Zhang's office just inside the ancient stone walls of the city. The frustrated and exhausted Zhang was relieved to see his old friend. Donald presented him with a letter from Mei Ling, urging him to release Chang and end the coup before it tore the country apart. The letter clearly affected Zhang, though he tried not to let on.
Donald and Zhang met with the officers who had been complicit in the kidnapping, including Yang Hucheng. The Australian scolded the mutineers, telling them that they should turn themselves in and release Chiang Kai-shek. Yang, whose interactions with the captive Generalissimo had gone particularly poorly, was unmoved by Donald's arguments.
After meeting with the generals, Donald and Zhang drove to Yang's headquarters to see the Generalissimo.
Chiang Kai-shek was still being held in the freezing cold, dirty room at the back of the young Marshal Zhang's headquarters. He had sustained a back injury during his initial capture and was in terrible pain.
When Chiang Kai-shek saw his old friend, he sat up in bed, wincing as a searing pain ran up his back. Tears sprang to his eyes as he whispered, "I knew you would come."
Donald told the Generalissimo that Mei Ling would also be coming to Xi'an, but Chang refused. He would not have his wife endangered. Then he turned to the wall and once more drew the blanket over his head. Exasperated, Zhang begged Donald to find a way to get through to him.
Donald asked Chiang Kai-shek to at least get out of bed and agree to move to the more comfortable house with heating.
After a long and unpleasant period of silence, Chang uncovered his face. He glowered at Donald before finally agreeing to go, but only if Donald would go with him.
Donald gave the Generalissimo his privacy as, for the first time in 60 hours, he got out of bed and dressed in full uniform. Finally, they were getting somewhere.
As they drove across Xi'an to the more comfortable housing, Chang reached out to take Donald's hand, holding tight to his only ally in the city.
When they arrived at the new house, Zhang led Chang into his new living quarters. Almost as a force of habit, Chang began chiding Zhang for his ill-thought-out actions. He railed at him for endangering the safety of the entire country. And like a good soldier, Zhang stood at attention until the berating was through.
Donald watched Chang scold this man, who he had always treated like a son. He could see the Generalissimo was heartbroken, betrayed by someone he dearly loved. Eventually, Donald stepped between them and sent Zhang off to dinner.
On the morning of the 15th, Zhang and Donald went to see the Generalissimo, a copy of the 8 points in hand. Yang Hucheng had been insistent that Chang hear their demands. He was worried his own men would turn against him if he allowed Chang to leave Xi'an without some kind of agreement.
Zhang read the points out loud. Chang's response to each was more or less the same. An angry lecture about how he wasn't going to listen to anything the young marshal had to say. Zhang maintained his composure.
Donald was impressed by Zhang's self-control. He tried to help the boy out, warning Chang that he had been blinded to the pro-Japanese intentions of the people he had surrounded himself with in Nanking. Donald urged Chang to consider at least some of what Zhang was saying, but as usual, the stubborn Generalissimo refused.
Following another failed meeting, Donald took a flight to the military center of Luoyang, a few hours east of Xi'an. From there, he could securely place a call to Mei Ling back in Nanking.
Mei Ling told Donald that despite her best efforts, the pro-Japanese generals back in Nanking were readying their troops for an attack on Xi'an. The only thing that would delay the bombings was the heavy snowfall that had begun that morning and would continue through the night.
As Donald left the military base, he found himself grateful for the inclement weather. It would keep him and his friends alive, if only for the night. But as his puddle jumper took off, he spotted 20 bomber planes in a nearby field, preparing for takeoff. He grew uneasy. Maybe the snowfall wouldn't keep them on the ground.
Sure enough, as Donald's plane climbed through the air, the bombers began to flank it. They moved into formation above, below, and to either side of the small aircraft. Donald was growing more anxious by the second. He knew this to be the work of Ha Ying-chin, the Kuomintang's most aggressively pro-Japanese general.
Donald's palms grew sweaty as the bombers moved closer to his plane. He figured they were merely sent to intimidate him, and they were doing a great job.
Then, without warning, the planes began to drop bombs on the fields and rivers below. Donald watched the ground beneath him light up in orange flames and smoke. This was no intimidation tactic. He was under attack.
We'll return to Donald's terrifying flight in just a moment.
Now, back to the story.
On the morning of December 16, 1936, 4 days into Chiang Kai-shek's kidnapping, William Henry Donald was on his way back to Xi'an. Kuomintang bombers had him surrounded, dropping bombs onto the countryside below.
Donald's heart was in his throat. At any moment, one of the bombs could come crashing through the roof of his plane, blowing him to smithereens. Thinking quickly, he directed the pilot to detour along the ridgeline of a nearby mountain range, suspecting that the bombers would not have enough gas to follow him off the route to Xi'an.
The pilot nodded and made a quick turn towards the mountains. The turn was so sudden they nearly hit a bomber plane, which swerved to miss them.
As Donald suspected, the bombers followed. The chase was on. They had to break formation slightly to avoid crashing into the mountains. Donald's pilot cruised along the ridge as the bombers slowly turned back, one by one. Donald finally sat back, safe, thankful for a slightly larger gas tank.
His plane arrived in Xi'an hours late and with barely a gallon of gas to spare. He had not a moment to waste.
Donald drove to the house that had been rented for the Generalissimo. When he arrived, he told Chang of the encounter he had had with the bombers. Chang's eyes lit up. He asked Donald if he thought the bombers would make another try.
This caught Donald off guard. It wasn't the reaction he'd been expecting, and he wasn't quite sure what to make of it.
The next day, Donald and Zhang found the Generalissimo gazing out a window and mumbling to himself. Why don't they bomb us? Why don't they bomb us?
Donald told Chang that the snow on the ground was the only reason Chang hadn't been bombed to pieces already.
The Generalissimo shrugged, telling Donald that giving up his life would be a price worth paying for the destruction of Xi'an.
According to historian Pishan Lo, Chang's desire for martyrdom was yet another defense mechanism. Chang's ego was threatened by his subordinates' rebellion, so he felt the need to create a grand narrative in which he could play a martyr in order to maintain his mental stability.
This is not necessarily common for hostages, but as Dominic Janes and Alex Howen pointed out in their 2013 study on the subject, martyrdom has long been linked to the Christian tradition. The early Christian martyrs represented, quote, extraordinary acts of spiritual heroism.
This is something that a Methodist like Chiang Kai-shek would have been heavily influenced by. In fact, Chiang Kai-shek compared himself to Jesus Christ, the ultimate martyr, several times in his account of the event.
Chiang went so far as to write a will while in captivity. He wrote to his two sons, telling them that he'd been born for the revolution and would die for the revolution. He told them that if they regarded him as their father, Sung Mei Ling must be their only mother, and when he died, they must obey her.
It is worth noting that the two boys both had actual mothers who were alive and well, and that his older son, Wei Kuo, had never even met Mei Ling, as he'd been living in the Soviet Union since 1925.
But clearly, that didn't matter to Chiang, who was too focused on his potential imminent martyrdom. Meanwhile, Zhang was beginning to change his mind about Chiang. Earlier in the week, Donald had presented Zhang with some pages from the Generalissimo's diary. They detailed an incident from years before in which Chiang had attempted to make a truce with the communists in order to attack the Japanese. The pages had a profound and immediate impact on Zhang, who was having his doubts about the coup. He was not seeing any popular support for the kidnapping and was beginning to wonder how he could possibly escape the situation with his life.
Then, to compound matters, Zhou Enlai arrived in Xi'an and offered his assistance. But along with Zhou's arrival came very bad news, which confirmed Zhang's deepest fears. The kidnapping of Chiang had failed to garner support from communist governments abroad.
At the time, Russia was under threat from a recently signed pact between Germany and Japan, which pledged to fight international communism. Stalin knew that if anything happened to Chiang Kai-shek, it was likely that the highly unstable Chinese government would give way to infighting and collapse in on itself.
The collapse of the Chinese government meant that there would be no one to stand in the way of a power-hungry Japan marching further into China. At that point, the Soviets would be facing the powerful and aggressive force of Japan along their Chinese border.
At the time, the Chinese communists were a small, weak guerrilla army. They did not have the resources of the Soviet Union and had to rely on Russia for much-needed military aid.
Stalin heard about the kidnapping on the morning of the 13th, and he immediately voiced his disapproval. The Chinese Communist Party had no choice but to agree with Stalin and adopt an official position advocating that Chiang be released immediately. As Zhang heard this, his stomach dropped. The entire mission had been an utter failure and had done more damage to communism than good. He felt ashamed.
The morning after his arrival, Zhou met with General Yang Hucheng, who was surprised to learn that the Chinese Communist Party was no longer advocating for Chiang's trial and execution.
But Yang wasn't sold on the idea of releasing the Generalissimo. He feared that if he released Chiang without any guarantee of immunity for himself and his troops, there would be severe retribution.
For his part, Zhang was feeling more conciliatory by the second. He sent a telegram to Nanking and arranged to have Chiang's brother-in-law flown in order to further negotiations.
Chiang's brother-in-law was T.V. Soong, a staid, glasses-wearing financier. In keeping with family tradition, he was a hugely influential member of the Kuomintang government.
T.V. arrived on the morning of December 20th, bearing yet another letter from his sister Mei Ling. She told the Generalissimo that if TV did not return in 3 days, she would come to Xi'an to live or die with her husband.
Mei Ling's letter elicited tears from her husband, but it failed to bring about the change of heart she had been hoping for. Chiang maintained that he would not agree to anything under duress. He insisted that the only solution to his predicament was for the nationalist armies to attack Xi'an.
Clearly, more reinforcements were needed. That afternoon, Donald flew back to Nanking to fetch Mei Ling. As Mei Ling would put it, quote, Donald had laid the foundations. Brother TV had built the walls. She would put on the roof.
For the past 3 days, Mei Ling had been fighting against the pro-Japanese faction in Nanking. It had taken all her diplomatic powers to stop He Yingqin from bombing Xi'an to smithereens. Even getting out of Nanking had been a trial. The pro-Japanese faction was not eager to allow any more moves that would lead to a peaceful negotiation of the situation in Xi'an.
As Mei Ling peered out the window of the plane, she saw the debris from a recent bombing being cleared from the train tracks that led to Xi'an. She was nervous.
When the plane touched down on the tarmac, Mei Ling pressed a revolver into the hands of her old friend Donald and asked him to shoot her if any of the soldiers tried to so much as touch her.
Donald assured Mei Ling that no one would lay a hand on her, but she was not convinced.
When the young marshal greeted Donald and Mei Ling at the airport, he appeared exhausted and a little ashamed. Mei Ling asked Zhang to stop his men from searching her baggage.
Zhang blushed and told her he would never do such a thing.
Mei Ling then told Zhang that all of China was against his actions and he should find a way to bring Chang home as soon as possible.
Zhang did not disagree with her. At this point, he was entirely ready to release Chang, but Yang and his men were not. They wanted some guarantee of their own safety before they would agree to let the Generalissimo go.
Zhang explained his position to a frustrated and disappointed Mei Ling. Zhang was relieved to hear that before leaving, Mei Ling had worked out a truce with He Yingqin to keep the bombs at bay until Christmas Day. If the Generalissimo was not gone by then, no one's survival could be assured.
In many hostage situations, one of the most powerful tools a negotiator has at their disposal is time. According to Professor Abraham Miller of the University of Cincinnati, the longer a hostage situation goes on, the more the hostage takers will find their will to maintain the standoff depleted. This leaves the negotiator with the chance to take advantage of the hostage taker. Usually, the longer the hostage crisis, the more likely it is to come to a peaceful resolution.
But unfortunately, there was no time to wait for Yang and Zhang to grow frustrated. The Christmas deadline was looming, and a peaceful resolution was seeming less and less likely.
In a desperate attempt to get himself and Chang out of Xi'an, Zhang proposed a plan. Mei Ling and Donald would fly to Luoyang while Zhang disguised the Generalissimo and smuggled him out of the city.
Mei Ling rejected the plan outright, telling Zhang she would not have her husband leave Xi'an in secret like a criminal.
The young marshal was out of options. Yang Hucheng would not allow Chang to leave without a guarantee of safety, and Chang would not give such a guarantee. As far as he was concerned, everyone who'd taken part in the coup was to be jailed or executed as soon as he got back to Nanking.
Thankfully, Zhang had one last card to play. He told Mei Ling there was one man who, if she would be willing to meet with him, might be able to convince Yang to release the Generalissimo.
His good friend, with whom the Generalissimo had enjoyed a game of cat and mouse for years, the communist Zhou Enlai.
The meeting between Zhou and Mei Ling took place on the morning of Christmas Eve, just hours before bombs would begin dropping.
Zhou pressed upon Mei Ling how important her husband was to the fate of China. He knew there was no one else who could lead China in a war against Japan. He promised Mei Ling that he would see what he could do with Yang, but first, he would speak to the Generalissimo himself.
Zhou, accompanied by Mei Ling and TV, visited Chang on the evening of December 24th. Zhang later confirmed that the meeting took place, but until his dying day, he never disclosed what was said.
It must have been an incredibly tense moment. Chiang Kai-shek had spent the last 10 years chasing Zhou through the countryside and had even put an $80,000 bounty on his head. In all that time, they had never spoken man to man.
Now, Zhou was the only one who'd be able to convince Yang to stand down and allow for the Generalissimo's release.
Whatever happened in that meeting, it was an unequivocal success. The next day, General Yang Hucheng announced that he was ready to let the Generalissimo go.
On Christmas morning, Chang awoke to see that Donald had hung stockings by the fireplace and placed gifts for him and Mei Ling beneath them. He laughed for the first time in weeks.
At the airport, Zhang boarded the plane with Mei Ling, Donald, TV, and the Generalissimo. He had volunteered himself for whatever punishment the Kuomintang had in store. The plane landed in Nanking to a crowd of thousands celebrating Chang's peaceful release.
For his part in the incident, Donald was awarded the Order of Brilliant Jade, the highest civilian medal given in China.
The tide of patriotic sentiment made it impossible for Chang to continue his fight against the communists, which, ironically, was exactly what Yang and Zhang had wanted. Chang was forced to join forces with the communists and begin pushing back against the Japanese.
Inevitably, this pushback led to war. The resulting fight was brutal. It lasted until 1945, and by the time it was over, the Nationalist Party was a fraction of what it had once been. By then, the communists had gained significant power and military might.
The final blow to the Nationalists came when a decisive battle was won by the communists in 1949. Chiang Kai-shek and the remnants of the Kuomintang government were forced to flee to Taiwan. But before he left mainland China, Chiang wanted to kill all the political enemies still under his control. There was one in particular who caught his attention.
Yang Hucheng had been under house arrest since 1936 for his part in the Xi'an incident.
Before he left for Taiwan, Chiang gave the order for his secret police to shoot Yang, one of his sons, his only daughter, and six members of his staff. Their bodies were doused in acid and then buried.
Chiang died in exile in Taiwan in 1975.
Zhang Shuliang was also put under house arrest almost as soon as he returned to Nanking in 1936. He spent his days in a pleasant mountain cottage just outside the village where Chiang had been born. After Chiang's death in 1975, he was officially given his freedom. Zhang moved to Hawaii, where he lived until the age of 100.
It's rare for one man to influence the fate of a nation. Zhang Shuliang wanted independence from Japan and longed for a nation free from government censorship. He gave everything to the cause. In the end, he sacrificed his own freedom so that China could be independent at last.
Thanks again for tuning into Hostage. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Hostage, as well as all of Parcast's other podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast directory.
Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Russell Nash, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Zoe Louisa Lewis and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.